WellPod at DC on Riot Radio. Let's explore what it means to be well.
From meditation, stress management, safer substance use, and sexual health, we will literally talk sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Join us to dive deep into some student health questions. We'll learn about wellness together, try some coping tools, and meet some interesting people.
Your co-hosts, Heather and Craig,
the perfect blend of Campus Health and Wellness Center and Sal's.
Each week, we'll DIY a wellness tool together
and then nerd out and dig into the science behind how it works.
Email your health and wellness related questions to wellpod@durhamcollege.ca to be discussed anonymously on air.
Welcome
to the WellPod at DC.
Welcome to the WellPod at DC, here from the Media Hub on riotradio.ca. According to addictionhelp.com, an estimated of 21% of Canadians, about 6 million people, will meet the criteria for addiction at some point in their lifetime. Our student question of the week to guide today's episode is, my partner won't stop drinking. I've tried to talk with them. I wish they would just stop. Is there anything I can do to help them? So today we're going to be trying our best to understand a little bit around the world of addiction. We'll talk about addiction as problem solving and end our show talking a little bit about harm reduction. A quote by novelist Mohsin Hamid says that empathy is about finding echoes of another person in yourself. If we are able to understand each other by stepping into another person's bubble, by diving into their beliefs, values, and by being more welcome to trying to find echoes of the other person in ourselves, we'll be able to create a better understanding of each other, which will make the world a better place. Joining us today is clinician and educator in addictions, mental health, and social work. Welcome, Carl.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. So tell us a little bit about this link between empathy and understanding addiction. How does empathy help us understand addiction?
Yeah, so that's really the name of the game for me. And I hope that comes through. If there's one big takeaway that anyone takes from this appearance of mine here, is kind of throughout this episode, I hope that I really plant the seeds of what I call, kind of mixing metaphors here, but building a bridge to better understanding addiction. And in that way, more compassionately and effectively responding to folks who are really suffering from what are biological, psychological, social, and in a very deep way, spiritual problems. And I think the first step to doing that, this is the connection to empathy, is that we really have to understand that this person, this type of person, the addict, that we unintentionally kind of marginalize and, you know, say, oh, that's not me. I put a big wall between them and me. Mm-hmm. We actually share so much in common with them. And that to me is the first step to helping people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You have a quote by Mark Twain.
Yeah. So this is actually something Carl shared with us. It was, but I think I've come across it before, and it's a good one. Giving up smoking is easy. I've done it dozens of times.
Yeah.
I really like that, because I think it speaks to all of us in terms of things we've gotten involved with that we then maybe have a goal to get rid of, and it can be challenging, of course. Mm-hmm. And so that being said, like, in terms of those challenges, what can you speak to in terms of what we come across when we're trying to make a change, but the challenges we kind of hit or come across?
Yeah, I love that quote. Sometimes I misquote it on purpose and I say, hey, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. That's me, by the way, too. I smoked for 10 years and I'd always be saying like, oh yeah, quitting smoking is really easy. And then I would just start smoking again. Mm-hmm. The point that quote is making is that initiating behavior change is actually kind of easy. You just do it, right? Or you tell all your friends on Facebook, I'm going to do it, right? Mm-hmm. But then maintaining it, sustaining it over time, that's the real battle. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I bring up that quote, this, I guess, the first way we can kind of build empathy, is I often teach people who, like myself, other than smoking and maybe a bit too much coffee and tea, I don't have lived experience with addiction, especially not chronic, heavy substance addiction, right? Mm-hmm. Like street drugs or alcohol. And a lot of my students, including me, think to themselves, how could I ever be in a position to help someone if I haven't lived it? If I haven't really been there, it's not really in my heart. Mm-hmm. And that was scary for me when I first started. So I thought of a way of introducing people to building that first piece of the bridge by having them answer 5 questions. So anyone who's listening to this or watching this, you can just kind of do this right now. I mean, don't shout your answers out loud if you're in public, but I ask people, Has there ever been a time in your life when you wanted to change something about your behavior or just something you were doing, right? Like some part of your life's not really going well, like, oh, maybe I should start working out again, or like, oh, my dad bod's getting a little too daddy, and right? Most people say yes. And if they say no, I go, thanks for showing me that you're a liar, right? I'm just kidding. But a second question is, have you ever tried to make a behavior change? And again, a lot of hands just go right up and they say, oh yeah. And usually thinking of that first thing that they were. And the third one is, have you ever been, say, not totally successful in making that change? Either because you didn't quite set out to do it, like I didn't go to the gym, say, or I didn't try this thing, or I tried it, like Mark Twain says in his quote, but I couldn't sustain it. Mm-hmm. Now, question number four, this gets a little bit harder for people. When you failed to make that change, did you feel bad about yourself? Did it hurt? Mm-hmm. Did your self-worth take a big hit? Did you feel like, oh man, I'm such a terrible, I'm so irresponsible, I'm lazy, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will put their hand up, right? And the final question is, were you made to feel even worse about that by the expectations of society, directly or indirectly? So my example too is like when I'm chasing that dad bod to go away, mm-hmm. I'm scrolling Instagram and oh man, look at all these guys killing it with their kettlebell workouts and CrossFit, and that makes me feel terrible about myself. And what I say to people is, if you understand that dynamic, and most people's hands go straight up for all five of those questions, you know fundamentally what it is like to be someone struggling with an addiction. Does that mean you know what it's like to have crystal meth addiction, mm-hmm. alcohol addiction, gambling? No, probably not. I hope not in your case. But you understand the deep psychological, spiritual dynamic of wanting to change, trying to change, failing to change, feeling bad, and feeling even worse because society just kind of either intentionally or unintentionally lowers that extra burden on you. Mm-hmm. And when students hear that, they're like, oh man, I can relate to that for sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's a feeling many know, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And I would imagine too, you kind of mentioned social media, right? And I would imagine with the younger generation now, we're exposed to what is often referred to as like the positive picture perfect reel of people's lives. And so our measurement too, when we talk about those societal measurements that we sometimes are held to, I would imagine it's much more visible of kind of this picture perfect lifestyle. So I would imagine for our younger listeners and our current students that they're facing that quite a lot. You can't really escape from it because your phone is often out. So we're constantly maybe bombarded with these images.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how deep we can get into this, but what you were talking about there, I sometimes refer to that as like the highlight reel effect.
Yes.
Right. So and the worst part about this is that I am often comparing my insides, my real lived life, you know, me watching, I'm sorry to say it, but reruns of Seinfeld for the 18th time, eating Cheetos, you know, in sweatpants. I know it's not glamorous, but that's what I'm doing sometimes. And I'm comparing that to someone's outsides, right? They're like their digitally carefully curated social media self. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I kind of suck, but I'm being so unfair to myself. Mm-hmm. And especially for the younger generation where they've kind of grown up with this technology, at least I was spared it most of my high school life.
Yeah. I'd imagine too, when we're faced sometimes with these feelings can be really challenging for us to navigate. And so we might notice some discomfort. And so what I find even in my own life is sometimes we want to avoid that discomfort. Yeah. And so sometimes we're seeking out what is sometimes referenced as short-term comfort. Carl, how does this show up in addictions where we're kind of avoiding short-term discomfort and seeking short-term comfort?
You've got it right there. I mean, that to me is the essence. If I was to give a universal, kind of uncontroversial definition of addiction, it would involve two things. First, it's any repeated, continued engagement in a behavior. So I just keep doing something despite negative consequences, usually long-term negative consequences. But the real core is the one that you were pointing to. An addictive behavior, a truly patterned addictive behavior, is one in which I am sacrificing my long-term well-being at the expense of short-term comfort or the avoidance of short-term discomfort. Or just put differently, in that moment, right, when I'm engaging in that activity, what I am doing is I am not meeting the present moment in any of its discomfort or stresses, whether that's anxiety or sadness or even boredom. I'm not meeting it head on. In a way, I'm putting it aside, or I'm turning down the volume on how bad it feels. And that to me is, like, if I was to think of like the existential core of addiction, that's it right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because kind of going back to what you said, asking the students and so on, even coming to mind is not necessarily even an addiction, but just, yeah, working out, like you said. Yeah. But, you know, I'd like to run a marathon, you know, next year. So I want to, I'm going to have to train to get to that.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's a year from now, right? Yeah. You have that long-term versus short-term, when it's like, so I should go for a run, not literally right now, I'll stick around, but like I should go for a run right now. And then it's like, yeah, well, maybe later, and you know, put it off and put it off is interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is the second way that I build a bridge with people, right? Because that example is lovely. Every time that, you know, Craig has to decide, I got to train for running right now. Like, that is Craig going, I have to, in this moment, do the thing that is not totally comfortable and easy and smooth and frictionless. I've got to do something hard, right? And that's not easy. I'm not like judging anyone. Like, the way I explain this to people is, there's this kind of hilarious, but like insightfully tragic study that came out in the States a while back. And it looked at people who were given a choice between either walking up the stairs or standing on an escalator, right? Now, of course, the people in question were not folks with serious physical health conditions or mobility issues. It's folks like, I'm guessing, the three of us who can otherwise, on most good days, walk up the stairs without pain, without injury. And they found that only 2% of us, 2% of us would willingly embrace the immiserating pain and discomfort of walking up some steps. Right? Whereas 98% of us instead chose the short-term comfort, the ease of just going up, right? And the reason why I say that to people is not because I consider myself to be part of that 98% in a lot of parts of my life. This is not me going, oh, see, listen to all of you. I want people to map that on to the experience of someone who is choosing in a moment of deep emotional pain, or they're dealing with flashbacks from trauma or really heavy anxiety or loneliness or grief. And that person has found, we'll talk about this a bit later, but like that person has found the perfect solution in that moment to the problem of feeling that bad. And we look at them and we say, oh, why don't they just choose to do the right thing? Well, I want to encourage people to be a bit more compassionate. Like we do the thing that we probably shouldn't do. We're 98 percenters in most of our lives too.
Yeah, and something, just going back to the running example, but is like, and that's so far away,
so far.
A year from now, I might sort of maybe have fun or whatnot at this race, and so small relative to some of the painful experiences that you're alluding to that the person has had in the past.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, a year from now, let's say I might be addiction free from, you know, meth. But right now, that's a long way off to be. Yeah, sorry, I'm just kind of processing here. But like, yeah, it's very insightful in terms of that that distance versus short term, as we've said. And so kind of along those lines, I'd say, I mean, we've kind of talked about this in terms of various things that then unify addiction. If you were to, if I can say, summarize or say, you know, what's the maybe one, maybe two things, but what's the key thing that unifies all addictions?
Yeah, so I'll go back to that starting definition to begin with, and then I'll kind of plant the seeds for, I know we're going to talk about problem solving and addiction in a second, but, or I mean, at the next segment, but I'll come back to first just really emphasizing this point that addiction at its core is continued engagement in a behavior despite negative consequences, which implies at the very least a reduced ability to self-regulate, to control one's behavior, right? We're not saying that someone's ability to control their behavior is completely gone, but man, if someone is engaging in a behavior, unless everyone was just a masochist, right? I'm just going to choose to hurt myself over and over again for no good reason. There's got to be a deeper, more sophisticated thing going on. And part of that more sophisticated explanation is what Heather was getting to before. It's this idea of, and the here and now, and what you were pointing to as, you know, right in front of my face, I sometimes explain this to my students as, it's a kind of nearsighted myopia. It's myopia because it's tunnel vision, but it's nearsighted because I can only see the short-term relief of my pain right here. That's real to me right now. I'm feeling lonely, I'm anxious, I'm sad right now. That future, you know, highfalutin well-being everyone's talking to me about, where my life's all together, mm-hmm. I can't see that. That's not real, that's mm-hmm. abstract. Mm-hmm. That's far mm-hmm. away in a way. So that's what I would say really unifies addiction. But if I were to kind of plant a seed for what we're gonna talk about soon, maybe I'll just kind of mention it, not to get too deep into the neurobiology, but really, we have inherited so many otherwise awesome survival-based systems from our evolutionary history. Mm-hmm. And one of them, I think this is the most brainy stuff I'll say today, is what's known as the mesolimbic dopamine pathway system, or the reward system. I call it the reward loop, right? Mm-hmm. And what this system does is it takes us, say, from a state of hunger, right, some kind of deprivation, to a state of non-hunger, satiation, by putting food in my face, mm-hmm. right? If I put food in my face, I can go from hunger to satiation. People are thinking, they're going, wow, give Carl the Nobel Prize. he's just figured out the, you know, like the key to existence. But map this on now to the experience of an addict, right? If I can go from feeling anxious or stressed or sad, whatever, put this emotional pain, and I can just go to feeling okay for even 5 minutes by drinking alcohol, by smoking a joint, by snorting cocaine, gambling, what have you. Mm-hmm. If I can go from that state to that state, it's the same system that gets me from hunger to satiation. The problem is that addictive behaviors hijack this. They exploit it and they turn up the volume to like 1,000, if that's even a real estimate, right? Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so scary. That to me is the core of addiction, that we can take ourselves from a state of not okay to okay mm-hmm. by engaging in that behavior.
And I would imagine too, with the different types of pain, whether it's psychological, emotional, physical, the level of urgency, when I think about, you know, even just stubbing your toe, yeah. right? You want that sensation to go away really quickly. And if there's a tool that you have access to that can help reduce that pain, mm-hmm. when that sense of urgency is there, you're going to seek the tools out to get you from those different states.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine too, you know, you talk about the definition having the idea of negative consequences involved. Some of those negative consequences, though, I would imagine aren't necessarily immediate. They may take a little bit of time mm-hmm. to fully come to the surface. And so then that, I would imagine, becomes tricky, because it's not instant negative consequence. It might be deterioration in some of your relationships, or longer term with some of your organs and health issues. So I'd imagine that's a complication too, is the negative consequences aren't in that kind of horse blinder that you mentioned earlier. They can be on the peripherals.
Absolutely. One of my favorite profs, in fact, he's actually a prof at Durham College right now, one of my good friends and colleagues, Dan Blom. Shout out, Dan. He had a really good way of saying this in the first class I ever took at DC, called Relapse Prevention. And he had put it this way: if we found a way to reverse the order in which the consequences showed up, like imagine if every time I drank alcohol, mm-hmm. I just experienced in, say, a moment, like somehow I was able to experience mm-hmm. decades of my life falling apart, mm-hmm. losing money, relationships, right? Opportunities, my health, I have cirrhosis of the liver. Imagine if I could experience, I would never go back to it ever again. Mm-hmm. The problem is that, like you said, Hera, like those consequences develop slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that develop more immediately, like say an acute hangover, or in some cases, you know, knock on wood, an overdose, mm-hmm. right? Those are so hard to see in the context of an immediate mm-hmm. relief of emotional and physical pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming up after this music break, we're going to continue exploring addiction, but more from the lens of problem solving. Don't forget, you can follow us on social media at DCSA Media Hub, as well as at Wellness at DC. Here is Bridge featuring Muna by Sterile Grove, right here on riotradio.ca. Thank you. Welcome back to the Well Pod at DC from the Media Hub here on riotradio.ca. Addictive behaviors ultimately are attempts to solve inedible problems of living. Carl, can you expand on this idea?
So again, this is, I would say, like the third, brick I would lay if I was building this bridge of empathy. One thing that we can all understand is that in every moment of our lives, and I hope I don't send people into a deep existential moment of crisis here, but if you pay really close attention, every moment of your life is something that you could find discomfort in. Whether it's just like, I'm kind of weird pain in my back here, or like, I want to really adjust how I'm sitting, or did I turn the oven off? Or it can be something like remembering someone that you've lost recently, right? Like a really deep pain. Every moment of our lives, even the positive ones, like how do I celebrate my buddy's awesome achievement, you know, or like I just got the job I've always wanted. What do I do with that moment? Those are all, many of them anyway, there are things that we have to respond to. Now, the problem is that most of these get kind of distorted over time in the mind of someone who's been struggling with addiction as genuine problems, first of all, that need to be solved. Now, some of these problems are genuine. My goodness. Like if you're suffering from the symptoms of a mental health condition, right? Anxiety, major depression. I have bipolar disorder, so I have to really be mindful of, you know, like the overall trajectory of my mood throughout the week and the month, right? If you're suffering with trauma symptoms, or even if you're just suffering with something really bad happening to you, like a crisis that you haven't anticipated, that's a problem that you need coping skills for. You need supports in your life. You need a way to respond to that effectively, right? That is not going to hurt you more than it helps you. But the other side of this is that many of our, you know, so-called problems, and again, this is not a judgment at all. I put myself in this camp a lot of the time. A lot of our problems, like say momentary boredom, right? Where I will just kind of, oh, where's my phone? And I will just start immediately, like the moment I have to spend even 30 seconds in my own head, right? I will try to solve that problem by filling the space, anything, content, what are my friends doing? Or have I checked my email today? If we map this onto addictive behaviors, right? Think back to what we talked about in that first segment. We have this built-in, amazingly powerful survival-based reward system that can take us from a feeling of not okay, of deprivation, not enough, right? I'm hungry, I'm sad, I'm anxious, I'm stressed, I'm bored. And it can take me from that to at least not feeling it, right? It's not a solution, but it at least takes me from that bad feeling to a comparatively not so bad feeling. The problem with addictive behaviors is that they become reliable, consistent, and totally non-judgmental, by the way, right? They don't talk back to me. They don't tell me I'm a bad person, right? And they're always there for me, right? As long as I could find them and they're accessible, they become reliable ways of getting me from X to Z, where X is my problem and Z is my solution. As long as I do that thing in the middle, that's how they become problem-solving devices for even non-problems, like boredom, or even momentary worry, or just, you know, like thoughts that I should be probably confronting, or mild physical pain. So that's when it becomes a problem for me.
It kind of reminds me of the theory of your window of tolerance.
Yes.
Right? So it's almost like, you know, different life experiences, different illnesses, trauma can really kind of shrink that window of tolerance. And so then these kind of everyday experiences of mild discomfort, because our window of tolerance has shrunk so much, they become larger in kind of are seeking for coping.
I love that way of putting it. And I'll use the metaphor that I borrow from the field of vision again, when I was responding to Craig's really good example around, you know, training to run and like you know, like the kind of tunnel vision myopia that we have of, well, I want to do this really good thing right now. We often notice, to me anyway, the first real sign that someone's potentially on a path towards some addictive behavior that's going to cause them real trouble in the long term is what I call coping myopia. So you might start, for example, having wine, right, every day after work, just to kind of unwind with your partner, say, or just, you know, like you'll have it, I don't know, with dinner, right? Because wine pairs really well with whatever you like. And, but then over time you start noticing, hey, I'm having wine before bed because I'm not getting sleepy enough. I'm having wine when I start getting kind of like jittery before that important phone call I have to have with dad. And, oh, I don't know if I want to talk with dad tonight. And then I start adding the reasons, the problems for which wine drinking in this case has become my solution. And now wine has now become this myopic single thing that I use to cope with everything. That to me is one of the first things I look for. If someone is not only using it to solve some problems, but most of their problems, that's when I know that something really dangerous is on the horizon.
Kind of tied to that, I think that was a good example relative to the student's question, right? Of the student's question was more about a partner who's maybe experiencing some of those things, right? And so if I get the question right, it says in there, right? I wish they could just stop, right? It's not good for you. Stop is something you sometimes hear, right? Or you hear the person saying, I could stop if I wanted to, you know, and things along those lines. So yeah, like what would be the response maybe to the individual, like the partner saying, I wish they would just stop, or even the individual that's maybe passes it off as, I could stop anytime. It's just wine before bed, just to have wine before bed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great way of framing it. In general, before I get into why it might be so hard to stop, I just want to tell anyone out there who's struggling, I want to look awkwardly into the camera, but you know, please go easy on yourself, right? All of these mechanisms that I am mentioning, they make things difficult for a reason. Just think of that survival-based reward system that you have. It's the same one that keeps you reaching for food, thank goodness, so that you won't die. It's just that in the case of, say, wine or cocaine, it gets mapped onto it and distorts it, you know, to 1,000% intensity. But what I really wanted to map on there is part of that student's question was around, why can't they just stop? You know, like, don't they know it's bad? Like something along those lines. And that to me implies, hey, like, aren't they sensitive to reasons, right? Aren't they sensitive to, can't they use their rational, intelligent, you know, faculties to just look at this objectively and go, oh my goodness, wow, come to think of it. Yeah, Heather was right there. Like, this is a short-term relief, but it's so costly in the long term. And the hardest thing, especially, you know, like for nerds like us, is that the problem with addiction cannot be resolved, right? At least straightforwardly in the moment with a strong mind. And there are two reasons for this, the way I explain it to people. For one thing, the first thing to kind of go offline, and I promised I wouldn't use another you know, brainy word, but you know, our prefrontal cortex is where all of our cognitive psychological magic happens, right? It's responsible for our problem solving, speaking of which, right? Our creativity, the fact that we can appreciate music and art and weigh options, and it's beautiful. But it's the first thing to shut down as soon as things get really stressful. And at the limit case, we have what's called a fight or flight response. And when that happens, that part of our brains becomes effectively useless to us, or almost useless. So that part of us that is so good at recognizing, hey, this is not good for me, come to think of it, you know, that come to think of it is not available to you. But it gets even worse than that. It's almost like, I feel like I'm Billy Mays, you know, but wait, there's more. There's more suffering. The part of it that remains, right? So say you're dealing with a mild craving. We're not talking about a fight or flight, I'm terrified response, or I'm really angry and my whole thinking brain just shuts down. The really scary part is that whatever part of my objectivity, of my rational mind that remains, it gets co-opted, it gets hijacked by what's sometimes called our limbic system, right? Our go area, like I want the drug, I wanna get it now, how do I get it? And the interesting thing is that the prefrontal cortex then becomes a really good way of helping, right, the impulsive, give it to me now limbic system of getting the drug as fast as you can. That's terrifying, right? Now, just to quickly, I know I'm saying a lot here, one solution to this among many is if you're going to help someone to appeal to reasons and to use their minds, we need to use it outside of crisis, right? So a client that I'd worked with recently had this beautiful way of putting this. He said, my recovery, Carl, is me spending 99% of the time getting ready to fight a battle that I'm only going to fight 1% of the time, right? And what he means by that is, He says, 99% of the time, Carl, I'm restructuring my life. I am making sure that my environments are this. And so I have good supports. I have coping skills so that in the 1% of battle time, when I'm dealing with a craving, when I get angry, when I get triggered, I don't have to think because my mind isn't ready to think in those situations. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how you want to view it. I mean, that's one of many tools that you could suggest to people. But if you're going to rely on your mind, make use of it when it's like not learning how to swim when you're drowning, mm-hmm. right? You want to learn mm-hmm. how to swim when conditions are nice and you've got someone teaching you, yeah. right? Don't learn how to apply coping skills during a crisis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And kind of maybe adding to that, if my analogy doesn't get too odd, but the partner who's the lifeguard has also learned how to swim long before that happened. And more maybe what I mean by that is something you said where sometimes, you know, the frustration comes out in the middle of the person going through their, let's say, drinking, right? Okay, well, you know, partner, you're drunk now and that's frustrating to me. Let's have a discussion right now while you're drunk.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to be a discussion for very long, I would imagine, right?
It's like, hey, I need you to do some laps with me right now in a really controlled way. And that person's like, I'm drowning.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That's more or less what's happening. But of course, we can sympathize and empathize with the lifeguard partner in this case, totally, mm-hmm. right? Because they're looking at that person going, I just want you to learn how to swim mm-hmm. and not drown anymore. Mm-hmm. But while someone's drowning, they're definitely not going to be responsive to those really good, understandable reasons. Mm-hmm.
The other interesting thing that came to mind as well is when we're talking about the prefrontal cortex and, you know, when it's online and when it's offline, it's not even fully developed until roughly age 24.
Great point.
And many of our relationships with addictive behaviors, addictive substances starts well before that age. I saw a study the other day that said the average age to first be introduced to pornography is around age 11, 12.
Wow.
Most are around 13 for having, you know, alcohol and cannabis introduced into their life. So it's tricky because the tools that are meant to help us problem solve and to help us with our coping tool development, it's not even fully developed mm-hmm. before we're starting to kind of tango and dance with some of these areas in life. So I would imagine that adds to the complications as well, as we're developing relationships, maybe some patterns, already starting to face some negative consequences, and our brain, we don't even have it fully structured yet to help us, like you said, reasonably and maybe logically sit down and go, is this a healthy avenue for me? Is this a tool? How do I engage with this substance in a healthier way? We're not even there yet as a young adult.
Mm-hmm. That's such an excellent point. In fact, the reason why I like you brought that up is because, I mean, I don't mean to be all doom and gloom, right? But all the points that I was making before about how, you know, the prefrontal cortex shutting down in moments of crisis, or how, you know, like whatever parts of your prefrontal cortex are still available, right, when you're experiencing a craving, they just get co-opted to go find the thing that you shouldn't be doing. I was assuming, really, in all of that, that someone's got a more or less fully operational online prefrontal cortex. And the excellent point that you bring up is that there is a massive high risk population out there, right? Many of them are walking around right now behind me on this mm-hmm. campus, right? Like you said, like up to age 24 or 25, the estimates are always changing, but something around the mid 20s, we don't get that important system coming fully online. So mm-hmm. right, it's why folks like me sometimes sound like that annoying, you know, person shaking their fist. It's so important that we actively mm-hmm. encourage people to at least take it easy, right? Youth, mm-hmm. I mean, to take it easy while these key neurological systems like the prefrontal cortex are still developing.
Mm-hmm. And the final thing that you said that really kind of made me start going down a little bit of a rabbit hole in my mind is, you know, it's not just logic and problem solving that our prefrontal cortex helps with, but you mentioned things like beauty and appreciation. And a lot of our coping tools, a lot of the students that I work with, they haven't quite found all of their coping tools yet to support them in life. And I would imagine that also has something to do with, you know, as our brain neurologically develops, as we're exposed to more experiences in different cultures, maybe we also need some compassion on it might take time for these skills to develop. It's not just as easy as go to the library, read a book on deep breathing,
yeah.
right? We sometimes need some deeper experiences and maybe even some more development neurologically before these tools can really come into play.
Absolutely. It's a great point.
Yeah. Coming up after the music break, we're going to talk a little bit about something called harm reduction. Don't forget, you can follow us on social media at DCSA Media Hub, as well as at Wellness at DC. Here is Bridge to Nowhere by Sam Roberts, playing right here on riotradio.ca.
another day breaks and the last one's gone. You dig deep just to carry on. Your debt's paid off, but it don't feel gone. So you slip out the back and you're moving on. Yeah. Figure out how to make a case that it don't amount to a fall from grace. She wants to know, can I replace this tired wool with satin lace? Sits you on a bridge, you know when you get that fast. Put it in the past, put it in the past. If this is a race, then I hope you come last. You're on a bridge, you know when you get that fast. It's a fool who believes love is bread in the bone. And there are no guarantees that you won't get stoned. Yeah, I'm a fool who believes love is bread in the bone. And there are no guarantees that I won't get stoned. Susie on a bridge, you know when you get there fast. Put it in the past, put it in the past. If this is a race, then I hope you come last. You're on a bridge, you know when you get there. And the last one's gone. You dig deep just to carry on. Your debt's paid off, but it don't feel gone. So you slip out the back and you're moving on. Since you're on a bridge, you know when you get that fast. Put it in the past, put it in the past. If this is a race, then I hope you come last. You're on a bridge, you know when you get that fast.
Welcome back to the Well Pod at DC from the Media Hub here on riotradio.ca. Carl, you refer to harm reduction as a compassionate response and pragmatic strategy. What are your views on harm reduction?
Okay, so just for a bit of context here, right? Because I'm one of the most staunch advocates. Before I even explain what it is, for any folks who don't understand what it is, I'm one of the strongest advocates you will meet out there. At the same time, right, I'll kind of show my hand here. I'm also a dad, right, to two daughters who are growing up way too fast. One of them just turned 10. Mm-hmm. And the thought of them ever touching a psychoactive substance to me is terrifying. And in my work with clients, I'm not going to pretend for a moment that I don't secretly wish that a lot of my clients who've been chronically heavily using, especially street drugs that are really dangerous to them, I'm secretly wishing that they just abandon it, you know? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I have to be realistic. That's the pragmatic piece. Mm-hmm. Harm reduction, in its essence, is exactly what it sounds like, right? When we're thinking about, just to simplify it for now, like psychoactive substances, right? We're thinking about alcohol, we're thinking about street drugs like cocaine and heroin or cannabis that's now legal, right? Harm reduction is a philosophy, but more importantly, it's a set of concrete strategies aimed at reducing the risk and therefore hopefully minimizing the actual and potential harm that is associated with, in this case, drug use. Mm. Now, that kind of sounds like, well, it's not bad, right? But a lot of people, their first introduction, unfortunately, to harm reduction is something like a safe injection site. And if anyone doesn't know what that means, a safe injection site is massively well supported by research to really help communities out and to help individual drug users out in our healthcare system. But it looks kind of scary, right? It involves having a place where people go and they're given a space to inject, heroin or any other drugs. And people are kind of introduced to like really sensational extreme ends of the harm reduction spectrum. But so it's a hard sell. So sometimes when I go meet with people, I have to start, and this is the fourth brick. I'm going to stick with this theme unless you guys stop me. This is my fourth major brick on the bridge to empathy, is I like to remind people, right, because I get a response a lot of the time, like, hey, aren't we just enabling people to use drugs? Aren't we like removing the negative consequences? Shouldn't people feel the rock bottom, right? You hear a lot of that coming from the 12-step world, especially. And there's a very real sense in which, yeah, that's true. Like, we are enabling safe drug use. We are shielding people as much as possible from unnecessary, you know, really damaging consequences. But what I say to people is, you know exactly what this is like. I'm not trying to be mean or aggressive, but you know exactly what this is like in so many other parts of your life. Think of driving. Driving is statistically like probably the best way that we can guarantee that we're going to get critically injured or killed, right? And it's a terrible way to travel. We all do it, right? How about playing contact sports? Like many of the awesome sports we have on campus, like, you know, like people, man, rugby, I used to play that one. That was brutal, right? Like, I used to leave with like, I couldn't even remember who I was sometimes, like hockey and football. How about just going out into the sun, right? Enjoying a nice sunny day like today. I don't know. How about having fun, intimate times, right? Mm-hmm. Sex, right? Mm-hmm. These are all activities that everyone would be uncontroversially in agreement. First of all, we all engage in them to some extent. Well, maybe not rugby and hockey, but like, you know, generally speaking. And they are all in their nature potentially very risky and harmful activities. Mm-hmm. And we would all agree that the solution, therefore, is not to go, well, stop doing that. We're going to pass laws against you doing that. And if you do it, we're going to judge you for it. And the only no one thinks that. Instead, what we do is we go, well, look, this is something that's never really going away. Like with cars, maybe when, you know, Tesla finally reaches those hovercrafts that we can all, but like, we're not getting rid of sex, right? We're not getting rid of walking out into the sun, right? We're not getting rid of contact sports for a really long time. How we've responded is to develop ways to engage in these otherwise really dangerous activities more safely. So that's kind of how I explain it to people. I say, like, that's where I want you to start. You do this in almost every other part of your life. The only difference is that yours doesn't involve a bottle or a needle, mm-hmm. or, as the case may be, a joint, mm-hmm. right? You just have a different thing that you're interacting with that presents danger, right? Mm-hmm. The second way that I kind of build this bridge to people, and it's the one that, and I really don't want to put us on a kind of like dark moment here, but it really is a literally morbid point. So I'm a dad, and I get emotional every time I think about this, but like, I can only imagine, right? Like, say my daughter, she's 10 years old, and in about four or five, sooner than that, right? Like you were saying, when it comes to pornography, some kids are introduced to it by age 11, you were saying. Mm-hmm. I know with substance use, it happens very early, sometimes even earlier than my daughter's age, mm-hmm. right? Like that really burns me up inside. And what I tell parents and teachers and administrators is I say, even if your goal, like mine, like I just admitted to you, is to ultimately help someone to stop, right? Because some people might just be inherently incapable of moderating, of controlling it. They might need to stop it. If that's your goal, I can only help you if you're alive. Mm-hmm. I can only help you if your son or daughter comes back to me. Mm-hmm. And I map that onto my girl, right? And I think, oh man, mm-hmm. like, I really hope that if my daughter is ever in that position, like I say this to my students, one of you may one day be in a position to be helping my daughter. And I really hope you at least get her to come back to the next session.
Yeah.
And you won't do that by just
wagging a finger. I think that's the piece missed that I see sometimes with harm reduction, is it's like this one and done. They're not understanding the nuances of, you know, getting connected to services and making sure not that in that moment you're safe, but the education pieces that are there as well. And I wonder if that's kind of the misstep that people make sometimes with harm reduction, is they think we're just kind of allowing, if you will, individuals to engage this way, but not understanding our goal is for them to come back. Our goal is that for them to get more education, develop more coping skills. Our goal is to be able for them to be here tomorrow so we can continue to empathetically build that bridge for recovery.
Mm-hmm. And as much as there's differences, I find that it's even where our culture is, in the sense of a physical issue versus a mental issue, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. I think our views on healthcare that I come across in our culture is, so I shared during the break, I think that I'm type 1 diabetic. Well, you wouldn't say like, Craig, can we just reduce the amount of insulin that you take? You know, if we could just get you there where you don't. But then when we get to mental health, it's kind of just like, we just need to get you to stop. Like, and fast, right? And it's like, it makes no sense under a physical context of that. When we get to the mental health, and as much as there's differences, and you could probably teach me some of them, but it's like that aspect of everything that you're saying totally just connects with me too, and also as a father, that why are we so focused that it's just a quick change and just get my son off of this stuff versus get him healthy, just like if they had something else going physically on in their body, that our goal is to get them back to the healthy state, no matter what length of time that it takes.
I'm seeing a lot of values kind of woven into this discussion. Sure. How does that concept of, having our own values and supporting other people's values weave into this idea of kind of harm reduction and addiction?
Yeah. So in so many ways, I could approach this from, hey, how can I help someone close to me who's struggling? Or how would I, as a psychotherapist, really focus a lot of my attention when I'm attempting to effectively intervene and help someone to change their lives for the better? Honestly, values are always at the core of it. I mean, it's the reason why, shameless plug, I named my private practice Becoming You. The idea behind Becoming You is, how can I help someone, whatever it is that they're doing in life, like whatever place they are, how can I get them to live in greater alignment with the person they want to be? Mm-hmm. And to me, I cash that out as, how can I get you to live in greater alignment with your chosen values? That's how I start with, like, if ever people meet with me, right, like they're almost annoyed by it because they're used to therapists starting out by going, okay, so how can I help you with what's wrong or what are you struggling with? My first question is, what do you love and care about? Mm-hmm. Or some variant about that. I always start with, tell me about all the things that you really want out of your life. I'm just really curious. And like a lot of them get caught off guard because they're ready for me to just pathologize, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to ask me for this long list of everything that's going wrong. If I start with values, that's a way of planting a seed, because what I'm going to do with that, and it's not like manipulative or anything, what I do is, right, I'm going to create in them, and here's some more nerd talk for any psych majors, I'm trying to create in someone a powerful experience of what's called cognitive dissonance. And everyone knows what this, it doesn't feel good, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you become aware of a conflict, a tension between either what you believe or like claim, like I really think the environment's super important and I'm driving a massive F-450 pickup truck on Queen and Spadina. Like when I experience a tension between my behavior and my deepest values, right? I experienced one the other day, right? Not having to do with drugs. I was on my phone, okay? Or I had my phone. This is how it started. I'm with my daughter. Okay. And I love playing Barbies with her. Okay, I'm just going to say that it's so much fun. And when that part of my life goes away, just like the last time I ever get to like pick one of them up, non-awkwardly, like, sorry, Dad, you can't pick me up at 15 anymore. I'm playing with her. And then I grab my phone and my daughter, she threw me into a state of cognitive dissonance. Right? And she goes, Daddy, why are you on your phone? She didn't go, Daddy, stop it. You're on your phone. You're a bad daddy. No. She says, Daddy, why are you on your phone? In a way, she was asking me, like, because I see you're so happy with me. You love to hang out. You love playing Barbies. She's only 7. She doesn't really understand deeply what this means. But you're claiming that this is so important to you, our time together. And what you're doing right now is actively undermining it, and it's certainly not getting you any closer to me. That's how I work with people. That's why values matter. It's not because I want to be like a moralistic, like, let's talk ethics. It's what matters to you, and in what ways is this life that you're living right now, the behaviors that you're regularly engaged in, right, whether it's addiction or anything else, how is it preventing you from getting those values hooked up to you?
No, that's really good. It's something I think we've talked about, and forgive maybe again a silly analogy here, but going back to the running, right, is I can say I want to run a marathon, or I could say I'm a runner. And what do runners do? Runners train. So yeah. I go for my run. It's not just that goal that is, yeah, far, far too off in the distance, but kind of the, like, who am I?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a little bit different, but tied to that cognitive dissonance that you're talking about. Yeah, it's really good.
I love that way of framing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we've not talked about it directly, but ACT is acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah. That's,
yeah, part of how you work with clients and patients and so on. Can you explain a little bit more about that and how it relates maybe to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so I know we're kind of running a bit short on time, so I'll give you my elevator pitch for how I use this, right? In fact, it just kind of brings together everything we've been talking about. So coming back to Heather's really good point at the beginning there, where addiction is fundamentally, in its deepest sense, a response, right, to something not being okay right now. I don't feel good, right? Or like, I want to feel something good right now, even at the expense of long-term negative consequences, right? A lot of my work in acceptance and commitment therapy, right, or ACT as we call it, because it's all about action, right, is about, it's about accepting, that's the acceptance part, accepting that it is just okay, right, for us to feel certain things that suck, right? Life has a lot of that going around, right? And part of responding to pain, right, is learning how to make space for it, right? To be present with it, to learn from it. A lot of our pain teaches us stuff. Like when I was with my daughter and she called me out on my phone use, that hurts. Mm-hmm. I could have just blocked that away, right? Mm-hmm. But I leaned into it. I felt it. I even got teary-eyed and I put the phone somewhere else. And that, like, that's a microcosmic small example of how I would apply ACT with someone. In that moment, that thing you're feeling, right? First of all, feel it, it's okay, right? You don't have to push it aside, right? It can teach you a lot about what in this moment matters most to you, right? And how you want to choose to live your life in the next couple of seconds.
Thank you so much for some of your insight today on helping us understand addiction at a little bit of a deeper level here. It's the end of our show today. Playlists, books, and tools that were mentioned on today's episode will be posted on our Instagram at wellness@DC. Next week, we are celebrating Oshawa's Music Week. We're going to be discussing music. But to finish our show today and to help us jam out, we have an original piece of music played by our guest, Carl, playing us out here on riotradio.ca.
All right, so this song is about addiction, and I wrote it based on what someone I had been working with a long time ago had introduced me to, this lovely metaphor. And I'm just going to dedicate the song to my lovely grandma, who turns 99 years young today. Yeah, she's awesome. But okay, here we go.
Moment in the ocean, I'm drowning. The demons in my mind are alive and they're feeding. Hold my hand as I fall into the sun. Can anybody see all the damage that I've done? Ties to the life I've been leading.
support. Can anybody feel all the damage that I've done?